You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. On this episode, I am delighted to be joined by author and historian Mark Hartzman to discuss his latest book, Chasing Ghosts. Mark acts as our tour guide in this fabulous collection, looking at a wide range of paranormal topics, from our fascination with ghosts, the rise of spiritualism, haunted locations, and much more. We focus on the rise of spiritualism in the mid to late 19th century, discussing amongst others the Fox sisters, the Davenport brothers, Andrew Jackson Davis, and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Looking at some of these notable characters, Mark explains some of their techniques, tricks, and claims that they made, amongst other things. Mark was great company in this first of four spooky episodes that are going to be released prior to Halloween. But before we get there, as always, you can support the show by signing up for Patreon. And a big thank you to my latest Patreons, Jeremiah, Moldol, Katinas, Erin, Cynthia, and Tim. I really do appreciate your support, so thank you so much for signing up for Patreon. If you want to join them, you can find the Patreon link in our show notes, or you can go on patreon.com and search for Mysteries and Monsters to sign up to support the show for $4 a month. You get early releases, ad-free episodes, and more. Mysteries and Monsters is also across all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you can subscribe to our channel on YouTube. You can also now get all your Mysteries and Monsters merchandise by clicking on the mysteriesandmonsters.com website. Just click on the tabs at the top of the page. As always, artwork for the show is by Dean Bestall. The show is produced by Brennan Storr from the Ghost Story Guides, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. So, the nights are drawing in, and the leaves are falling from the trees. What better time to go chasing ghosts in the company of Mark Hartzman? As the nights draw in and Halloween appears on the horizon, what better time to embrace the paranormal in the company of author, journalist, and historian Mark Hartzman? Mark's latest book, Chasing Ghosts, is a beautiful collection of the supernatural, as Mark acts as our tour guide in the history of the supernatural. Mark, I'm delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters, sir.
Oh, glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
What a wonderful collection. As we were talking off air, this book really does remind me of some of the fabulous books I used to read as a child. And I know that your parents clearly enabled your love of the supernatural, because I think in the book, in the collection at the end, you refer to the fact that your parents treated you to several books on the paranormal as a child. So as someone that seems to have had a lifelong love of strange and weird things, is that where your love of ghosts comes from? Because this book feels like it's one that you wanted to write a long time.
It is something that I've really been fascinated with for a long time. And yeah, when I was a kid, I would get those. They would have these, you know, Time Life type books. And there's another series as well, with ghosts would be one, and UFOs would be another, and probably, you know, monsters, dragons, all these kinds of fun topics. And I loved them. You know, they were beautifully illustrated. They had just fun stories in them. So those were something my parents did get me when I was a kid, and I really liked those books. I still have them. And so I was always fascinated by it since childhood. And I was also kind of fascinated just by the idea of whether or not there's an afterlife and whether or not our consciousness survives. Hmm. And I used to have these weird thoughts, and I still have them, about wondering whether what we do after death is the right thing in terms of burying people, and whether or not putting someone in the box and burying them, you know, just the question of what if that's wrong? You know, what if our consciousness does survive, but it can't escape from a box underground. I mean, these were just thoughts, you know.
Yes.
But it's a little terrifying. Like, oh, what would that mean for eternity? And have billions of people kind of screwed themselves by this ritual. So these things have always kind of been swirling in my head.
Yes, yes, absolutely. It is one of those facets of the paranormal that I think it's one of those things that is quite a frightening subject, even though these days it's treated sometimes with a flippant disregard for the memories of the dead, it would seem, if one watches most paranormal shows these days, where we it's a very interesting modern era for me, because there's a lot of parallels, as you touch on in your book, because it's broken down into several sections, which are a fabulous overview of certain key parts of the paranormal. And right now, it seems that there's a lot going on that mirrors that kind of spiritualism boom that we saw after the First World War, and also the Spanish flu, rather ironically, that swept across the world just post-war era. And it's very interesting for me, currently, obviously, in the times that we're in, that I've had discussions with other parapsychologists and people who have a love of the paranormal, Mark, that are we once again on the cusp of another sort of explosion in this kind of exploration into the voices of the dead?
Well, there certainly has been a boon in paranormal type of programming, lots of ghost shows on TV. You can watch them all day here on that travel channel.
Mm.
But it's interesting, you know, you mentioned World War One and the Spanish flu, and here, of course, also the Civil War was a huge, you know, uptick in spiritualism. And so just along those lines, the idea of tragedy, you know, often leads, you know, mass tragedy leads people to wanting to believe. I think grieving people wanting to be able to reach out and make a connection with their lost loved ones. So, you know, given where we are in the world the past, year and a half now, it wouldn't be surprising if more people are trying to reach out through mediums or choosing to believe.
I mean, when you decided to draft the book, Mark, was it a kind of intention to have it in these sections? Because you've kind of broken the book down into sort of the history of it and some famous locations and famous people, alongside other sort of tidbits of paranormal information and education, really. Or was it one of those where the book kind of started in the germination process and that just seemed an obvious fit for you creating it?
I did know I wanted to have it in sections.
Mm.
In fact, at one point I had an additional section that was going to be more pop culture related, but I decided to just sort of weave in some pop culture moments throughout it.
Mm.
Rather than try to go too deep into that, because that probably just would have gotten a little bit repetitive, and there's just a ton.
Yes.
So, you know, part of the challenge is balancing everything. You know, there's so much material, so it becomes a question of, okay, well, what are known stories that should be covered, because it'd feel weird if they weren't covered, and balancing that with stories that are hopefully a little bit less known and therefore, you know, intriguing to people who've read a lot on the topic. So there's something, a little something new and interesting for everybody, ideally. I started with the section on spiritualism, because that's what's been a particular interest to me for the past few years. I had really started growing my fascination with that era and buying a lot of old books on the topic. So a lot of books from the late 1800s and early 1900s, which I just find them just fascinating, that this was a time when people, you know, millions of people were really believing that we could definitely talk to the dead. And you had all these mediums doing these amazing manifestations and seances and, you know, creating these different effects. It's just a fascinating time to me. So I love the stories in those books. I love the design of those books, the titles of the books. So for me, it was like being able to share those stories is kind of where it starts from.
Yeah. I think one of the great aspects of all that as well is there are so many characters in that spiritualism era, from all continents and all walks of life, Mark. It's amazing just how many people were able to communicate with the dead or pass on messages of loved ones. And I think, as someone that's also had a lifelong fascination with the paranormal, it's perhaps a subject I've not looked into as much as an adult as I did as a younger person, Mark. I think as I grew older, I became extremely skeptical, and it's only sort of recently I've sort of started looking back at that era, primarily as a lover of Sherlock Holmes and Arthur Conan Doyle's obvious obsession with several paranormal and Fortean subjects, you know, alongside his deep and powerful belief in spiritualism and everything that it entailed, was obviously his involvement here with a very infamous case, which was involving fairies.
yes.
that were allegedly caught on camera at the bottom of some children's garden and the whole scandal that exploded over that. And for me, that, I think, encapsulates just how powerful the whole movement of spiritualism and the question of belief is when it comes to this subject, because many people would say that Doyle was a deeply intelligent, thoughtful man, very learned, very well educated. And yet, I think when we look back through the prism of history and the evidence as we see it in this day and age, Mark, it does seem remarkable some of the, I think the kindest term I can use is characters, once again, that that Conan Doyle seemed to be absolutely convinced had these psychic abilities.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because as the creator of Sherlock Holmes, you know, the great detective, his personal detective skills seem to be, you know, a little lackluster. But I mean, his beliefs were just, they were remarkable. The books he wrote that book, The Coming of the Fairies, based on what you were just discussing. And the photos are great. It's like, yeah, they were like two teenage girls who completely duped him.
Yes.
So it's quite interesting. You know, he had spoken to, believed he had spoken to his son who had been killed in World War One. He'd already been in seances in the late 1800s and was fond of that. But I think he really became an evangelist after believing he spoke to his son. But, you know, I would say, you know, part of it is also just, I think, taking in context the era he was living in to some degree, that around him, you had all these new technologies that were coming up, you know, telephone, radio, and these were sort of magical technologies, if you think about it, right? Like, voice is now traveling across great distances, you know, either through the phone wire or like through radio waves. And so you're kind of discovering this invisible world to some degree. And yeah, at the same time, like overlapping the exact same era, this was in my last book called The Big Book of Mars. Do you have some of the world's smartest people, including Tesla, Marconi, lots of Harvard, you know, various Harvard professors and other professors at prestigious universities, believing that we could, that there's intelligent life on Mars and that we were trying to receive messages from Martians?
Yeah.
So here you have another odd type of thing. You know, you have invisible voices traveling from distances, you know, through invisible waves. You have intelligent life on Mars, life on other planets. So with everything kind of brewing with spiritualism, maybe the thought that connecting with the dead didn't seem that out of hand. You know, it was like, well, sure, we're just, you know, cameras were relatively new, capturing images on film. So maybe there's just this belief that there is this other invisible world or other worlds out there. And, you know, maybe it's not as sort of bizarre as it may seem, just thinking that he had this belief, you know, in isolation.
Yeah, it did seem like nothing was off the table in those sort of post-Victorian era, Mark, as you referred to. And anything went. And I think, you know, I've spoken about the search for intelligent life on Mars and the people that were claiming they could see people through telescopes and these canals. And as you refer to, Tesla and Marconi were claiming that messages were being beamed to us and we were trying to build this relationship. And it is very interesting how the Mars thing seems to run in parallel with it, that people had this concrete belief that people did live on Mars. And obviously, for many people, I suppose the best example of that is the furore that kind of exploded after Wells's publication of War of the Worlds, which essentially says that these Martians are not very friendly and just want to take us over. But as you say, the eminent scientists of the time and the people that we would consider the great thinkers and scientists of the era were absolutely obsessed with this idea of communication. So that's an excellent point, that it's not much of a leap, especially when you consider, say, somebody like Edison, who was desperately trying to create his telephone for the dead, wasn't he?
That's right. Yeah. In 1920, he made that announcement in October.
Ironically. Yes. And it is fascinating. And I think sometimes, as you say, we have to sort of take a step back and perhaps not be as dismissive of these ideas and these thoughts and these things at that period of time. Because like you say, there was a lot going on. And it is very interesting for me as a Brit, Mark, obviously, because when you touched on there about the rise of spiritualism really kind of started just before, sort of the decade before the American Civil War. And obviously that was such a cataclysmic conflict that affected every state and essentially every family across the United States. It is very similar to what happened after the First World War, so that you had a lot of grieving families who didn't have any closure. And I suppose spiritualism sort of thrived in that kind of environment, didn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that mediums were, you know, saw that opportunity was knocking and were happy to answer that door and provide whatever services they could, no matter, you know, maybe some were legit, but so many of them were fraudulent and were proven to be fraudulent. Again, it's one of those fascinating things. And someone like Doyle would have said, well, sure, there's plenty of frauds, but that doesn't mean they're all frauds. You know, so he would firmly believe that there were those who were authentic, even amidst the rest of them who weren't.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, I suppose you work on that principle as with anything, Mark, that's unusual or strange, that, you know, if somebody said, well, you can pick up something and talk to somebody in a different city, you know, in the mid 1850s, they'd have thought you were talking about witchcraft. And it's also very interesting as well, right, that you look at photography, and obviously these days we are quite dismissive in regards to photography. I think people forget just how mind-blowing that must have been, that people could actually capture an image, you know, 150 years ago, which in this day and age, you know, everybody takes pictures every single day. It's just something people do as a general reaction to any situation, it seems, these days. Whereas back when photography first started, it was an event.
That's right. You know, if you had one photo of yourself or your family, that was, you know, that was a big deal.
Yeah.
Now it's, you know, selfies all day.
Yeah. Very true. Very true. And yeah. I think in regards to this kind of rise of it, in your book, there's a wonderful section that focuses on many of the people involved and the well-known names from that era. And I think it would be easy to start with probably the most infamous, I suspect, whenever you mention the subject of spiritualism, which is the Fox sisters. And for me, it's quite funny because I've recently been researching some old articles from British newspapers. And it's very interesting to me that I stumbled across one a few weeks ago, Mark, from 1852 over here in the UK. And it's basically somebody talking about a trip to the States and they're touring around and they find themselves in Foxborough and are invited to a performance of this new wave spiritualism that seems to be sweeping the northeastern corner of the United States. And it's essentially someone talking about meeting the Fox sisters.
Hmm. Yeah, they, I mean, they traveled all over the country and then across the pond as well in England, in Europe. So, I mean, they were incredibly famous, you know, and they started, of course, they started in 1848 in their small home in Hydesville, New York. And, you know, they were just kids. They were like roughly 11 and 13 years old. Different sources say different things, but roughly those ages. And I think they just started, you know, making these sounds with their joints, their toes, that sound like knockings and rappings, and convinced their parents that they were communicating with the dead. And they were like literally overnight sensations. You know, the next day they had the whole town would like flock to their home to witness this. And then from there, you know, they just took off. Their older sister, Leia. So this was Maggie and Kate were the two young girls, and their older sister, Leia, had lived in Rochester, and her husband had left her. She had a kid, and that was a bad position to be in, you know, as a woman in that era. You know, you were left, you know, single woman with a child. It's not a great spot to be in, not a lot of job opportunities at that time. And so here was a new job opportunity, you know, manage your sisters and communicating with the dead. I mean, this was like power, right?
Yeah.
So she really, really ran with that and, you know, brought them to Rochester. They did well in Rochester, and people suspected them. Like, there were doctors who tested them, were like, oh, you're just doing this with your knuckles, we think. We don't think this is real. And they're like, oh, it's real. And of course, all their believers defended them and continued to believe. But yeah, then they went down to New York City and things really took off from there.
Yeah.
But what I love is the fact that eventually they came clean. Later, 40 years later in 1888, they're like at a spiritualist convention in New York City and said, oh, you know, we were just doing this with our joints and our knuckles and they would replicate the sounds on the stage, and the spiritualists didn't want to believe that. They said, no, no, no. Now you're just trying to capitalize on not being a spiritualist. We know this is real. So again, it's just very, you know, it was too late to make a confession at that point. The ship had sailed.
Well, I think that's one of the interesting aspects of all this. Because, I mean, when I've heard this, I'd love to hear how loud their joint cracking was, Mark, because I'm a man of a certain age. So parts of me make noises when I don't want them to, usually, you know, and, you know, my knees cracking, my toes cracking and things like that. And I've never been in a situation where somebody's gone, oh, my God, it's the spirits of the dead talking, you know. Somebody's gone, oh, are you all right there? You know, I've got a bit of arthritis. And I find it remarkable that if we're led to believe that this is what these girls do, and, you know, it was very well attested that, as you refer to, people tested them and they said, yeah, it's just your knees and you're popping your toes and things. How loud or these buildings were, I mean, was it because they were performing in wooden buildings and they were echoing more or what? And it's remarkable that something so simple, if you put forward that it's being created by something unworldly, convinces people that it has to be something else.
You know, it's a good point, and it's just a shame that there's no recordings. You know,
yes.
That technology was not there at that time and, you know, didn't come into, I mean, I guess it may have overlapped a little bit toward the end, but as far as I know, there's no recordings, but I would love to, you know, hear that as well and see just how loud were these noises that they were so convincing. But I think there was also just the perception that these two young girls, you know, innocent children, how could they possibly, you know, dupe us, and like, why would they ever lie to us? You know, why would kids do that? I think there was a real belief and, you know, a trust in these innocent young girls. And I think that obviously worked in their favor.
Yeah. It is remarkable, really. Like you said, I think there's a lot going on here as well, because you have to look at the cultural situation, as you refer to with Leah and her relationship and essentially managing them for the rest of her life. This is probably one of the first examples of women having a lot of power and being able to hold a room of men captive, it would seem, Mark, as well. And I think there's a lot of sort of unspoken discussion in regards to that kind of aspect of all this, because a lot of the main proponents of spiritualism in the 19th century were female, and therefore I think they played on this kind of perception by obviously superior men of the era, shall we say, who were essentially easily duped by, as you say, how could women and children be lying to us? It must be true.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a good point. And if you don't mind, I want to read a quick quote from the book.
Yeah, go for it.
I definitely get into that whole concept that you're talking about. And this was from a great performer and historian. His name is Todd Robbins. And he said this, which I just, you know, I think encapsulates what you just said. He said, there was a very strong belief among the male population that women were not smart enough to deceive them. When you have scientists approaching this and they're not looking for deception because they don't think that women are smart enough to deceive them because they're important, intelligent men, it was a lot easier to do just that. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of truth to that. Like, well, there's no, you know, we'd certainly recognize any deception if it was here, because we're, you know, we're the smart ones. No way that they could fool us. So ruling that out, it would seem that ghosts are in fact, you know, coming through these women. But so I think there was a little bit of that going on, and yes, I think it was an opportunity for women to have a position of power. You know, they had no power within any religion, right? So here's a religion where they are receiving messages from the dead, and at that point you have to listen to them, and they are the powerful ones. And this is not to say that there, you know, there were plenty of male mediums as well, but there were, I'd say, probably more female. It did seem to lean more towards female mediums. So yeah, I think they definitely saw opportunity. And for a lot of these women, you know, they might not have had chances to really, you know, they were housewives basically, right? Like, they didn't have a lot of jobs to go to, or they would basically be at home. And here was a whole new adventure they could have right from within their home. You know, reaching out to the beyond and drawing attention, and it was quite lucrative as well.
Well, that's the other aspect, because I think some sort of people have claimed that the Fox sisters especially were earning between $100 and $150 a night, which for 150 years ago is a frightening amount of money.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and so they were clearly a big source of revenue for a lot of people. And whenever you have a situation like this, Mark, people will tend to congregate around it. And I think one of the other remarkable aspects, as you said about people sort of coming around and doing experiments and examining the sisters and being quite dismissive of it, people didn't care. I think that's the other aspect of this, that anybody that kind of tried to sort of poo-poo spiritualism and the Fox sisters or anything like that, and you could probably apply this to most of the celebrated psychics of the era. Anybody that said, no, it's all nonsense, this, they were just, oh, well, you're biased, you're against this, you won't open your mind to the potential of spirits talking to you. And so, therefore, they just didn't care that people were able to prove that the Fox sisters were just cracking and banging and things in their vicinity. And there's a bit where you discuss one of these experiments that was undertaken with them, where they placed the Fox sisters in a room and put their feet on cushions and things, and unsurprisingly, the spirits couldn't talk.
Right. That's exactly right. Oh, well, the spirits just aren't talking to us right now. I mean, there was always an excuse you could have, right? And just like you said, the people who were against the skeptics could just say, well, you're not opening your mind, as you mentioned. I mean, that's kind of a human nature with anything, right? You always find a reason to say that, well, this is why you're saying these things. But yeah, I mean, it was amazing that they would have this evidence and they could just explain it away.
Mm.
And that's consistent with lots of mediums, you know, throughout the area, that if they were caught, and not to jump away from the Fox sisters right now, but if they were caught, I'll give an example of Eusebia Palladino, an Italian medium who was quite famous and did a lot of remarkable things. When she was caught, one of her staunchest believers, Harewood Carrington, a psychical researcher who was completely, you know, taken by her and believed everything, he said, oh, you're right. She does fake things sometimes. There's definitely times when she's faking it, but that's because she can't have the spirits always come through, and she's always being investigated and researched, and she's kind of put on the spot, and she has to perform. And spirits don't always perform on demand. So that's why sometimes she fakes things just to put on the show that's expected of her.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, of course she faked it, because, you know, you can't expect the spirits to obey and, you know, be timely every time. And if you think about it, like, well, it's not the worst argument. You know, yeah. who's to say that spirits are always going to play ball?
Well, yes, of course. I think we know enough about the paranormal to know that spirits very rarely do what they're supposed to do when they're being investigated anyway, even in serious scientific endeavours, Mark.
Right.
And it is surprising that there are always these things, like, as you say, I've seen other people say, well, they didn't want to let the audience down. The people had come and they expected a performance, and that's why they've done what they've done, because they didn't want to let people down.
Yeah.
Which is, like you say, it's a hell of an argument.
yeah, it is. I mean, you know, especially if they're paying, right?
Yes.
Put on a good show.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the other pairs of characters, and reading this section of the book really made me chuckle, primarily because I know there's a very similar modern version of this situation. And this is these talented brothers, the Davenport brothers. And what I find remarkable about this is, once again, we're talking about some people who are able to claim to be channeling the spirits. They build up a local following. They then get, I believe they get invited to perform in New York. They're kind of following the trail that the Fox sisters have already blazed ahead of them. They get caught out rather amusingly, that it would seem that, oh, well, the career's over. Oh, but they think, no, what we need to do is do something that makes it easier for us to get away with it.
Exactly.
So can you tell us a little bit about these wonderfully cheeky, I think is the nicest term I can use, the cheeky Davenport brothers?
yeah, of course. So the Davenport brothers, they really did follow on the heels of the Fox sisters. And in fact, they grew up not far away from the Fox sisters. It was this whole sort of Western New York thing that was going on, that was really where everything was brewing.
Yeah.
So this was early 1850s. So again, Fox sisters started in 1848. So this was really right after. And they had learned basically to escape from ropes, from knots. So they would hold these, you know, seances in the dark. They'd be seen tied up in their chairs, and they'd have instruments all around them. And once the lights went out, the instruments would start to fly around the room and would play, I want to say play music, but it was probably just playing noise. You know, guitars, tambourines, banjos, horns, you know, a variety of instruments. And then when the lights came back on, the instruments would go back down. And by the way, people might get hit in the head with an instrument along the way.
Yes.
Lights would come on, instruments would be back down, and the boys were still tied in knots in their chairs.
Mm.
But because they learned to loosen themselves, and I don't think they were completely untying themselves. I think it was like loosen themselves enough to free a limb or free a foot or both and grab an instrument and, you know, wave it around, maybe toss it to each other. Not exactly sure about that, but basically make the instruments fly around the room. Maybe they could get up out of the seats as well and kind of run around with these things and make the noise and then reapply the knots, basically tighten them back up again. So it looked like nothing had happened by the time the lights came on. So yeah, they went to New York City with this show, and in one of the shows, someone turned on a lantern and saw one of the boys running around with the instruments. So they were caught, and they explained it. I think they tried to explain it away as, you know, evil spirits that were, you know, causing the disruption, maybe made the boy do that or some nonsense. Right. But yeah, they kind of like fled back to Buffalo with their tails between their legs, but they retooled their show. Mm. And, you know, it's funny to think about, again, the era they're living in. It's not like today. If this was written about in New York City or people talked about New York City, it was more or less staying in New York City. You know, it wasn't no social media to follow every move you make. So I think that certainly helped them. But yeah, they went back to Buffalo and they built what was known as the first spirit cabinet. And so the spirit cabinet would be split into three sections. It would be raised off the ground by a couple of sawhorses. And on the left and right side of this cabinet, they would go in, sit inside it on a chair, and they would be tied up. Someone from the audience might come up, tie them up, and then close the door. And then the middle section had a door as well and a window at the top. And you would see once the doors closed, that's when everything began, and the instruments would fly around and play again. And you could see them flying through that window in the middle door. So you could see the movement as you heard this crazy noise. And they could just do the same thing there. They could loosen themselves up, grab the instruments, make the noise, tie themselves back up before it was over, and let the doors open and reveal that they were still tied up in their chairs. And this way, if someone turned on a light, you were safe because you were hidden behind the door. It's pretty genius. And so then they resumed their tour and did very well. And they too went across the Atlantic and performed across England. And they were actually a famous magician from England, John Maskelyne, was attending one of their shows. And I think he walked by and saw something that was going on through the window and figured out their act and began replicating it himself. I think early in his years as a magician. But yeah, I mean, the other interesting thing about the Davenports is, you know, they had a manager, a showman, a talker, who would basically introduce them, explain what was happening. So they were sort of just doing the act. They weren't really communicating with the audience on a one-to-one basis like this talker would. So they never actually claimed that they were spiritualists themselves.
Mm.
They were just doing this thing. And you could believe what you want to believe, you know? Like, they never said we were conjuring the dead.
There's a lot of strange things about these guys as well. Like you say, their father, I believe, was a police officer. And it seems that he trained his children to be able to loosen binds and get free from being tied up, as though a parent would expect that to occur to their children, Mark, which I find a remarkable part of their story, that their dad thought, yeah, that'd be a really good thing to know.
Like, hey, you know what we could do? What do you boys think about conjuring ghosts and touring the world and making a lot of money?
Yeah.
All you got to do, let's practice our rope escapes. So, yeah, it's funny. And they would also have, there were a few instances, I think also in England, where people would tie the knots too tight.
Mm.
And I think at one point they started bleeding and I think they just called it off. But they would also do things like, if someone was starting to tie a little tight, they could kind of make a small movement, like a, you know, like a, almost as if they were in pain. And then instinctively, the person would kind of let up. You know, I think they kind of knew how to work the people who were participating as well. And sometimes they would call up, like, you know, because a lot, they're so famous, they have a lot of celebrities attend their shows. And they kind of knew that, like, well, if we call this celebrity up, they're not really going to be well-versed in knot tying, you know? Like, who do they know about tying a good knot?
Yeah.
They'll just, I mean, if it were me, I wouldn't know anything about it, you know, tie like a regular knot like my shoes or something. Yeah. So I think they also kind of knew who they should call on to help participate.
Yeah, I think they definitely avoided anywhere where there may be a chance of the audience being made up of sailors, Mark.
Yeah, right. Like, not that guy.
Yeah, he's just come back from a year at sea. No, we're not having him. He knows more knots than we do, so we'll not have him. But it's exactly. There's lots of little things and little tricks that they did, I think. Did they used to claim that, oh, well, we can't be faking it, because look, I've got a handful of flour. But when they got in the spirit cupboard, all they'd do is put it in their pocket, wipe their hand, and then at the end they'd grab some more flour from somewhere else and go, look!
Exactly. Yeah, that was one of the tricks. I wrote about that in the book. Yeah, there were a few little things like that that would help prove their authenticity. So, yeah, I mean, they were clever.
Yeah, yeah. I like the tip, the little touch as well of painting the instruments with phosphorus paint, which gave them this kind of unearthly glow as well, which I suppose, like you say, it's incredible when you think back that these people say, oh, well, we can do this, but it needs to be dark. Or we need to be in something you can't see to perform, because otherwise it just doesn't work. And it comes to a point where, are people just going to be entertained, or are people believing something otherworldly is going on?
Yeah, and that was kind of across the board, right? Like, oh, the spirits, they're only going to talk to us in the dark, which is a weird thing if you think about it. In fact, talking to, you know, modern day parapsychologists, you know, they'll say, like, most of our investigations are during the day, and most of the occurrences we investigate are happening during the day. This whole thing at night is a little ridiculous.
Yeah.
But it's the same thing you see on TV shows. It's like, it's more dramatic at night, right? Yeah. So I think that adds to it as well.
Yeah. Well, the often given excuse for that is, well, it's quieter at night, there's less people about. But if you're in an old abandoned haunted house, I don't really see how that's that's a valid excuse for doing it at night rather in the day. It's one of those things about the paranormal is, I don't think it works nights. You know, it seems to be an all 24-hour occurrence often.
Yeah, I would expect so, yeah. I mean, why would spirits care one way or the other? I mean, it's hard to, obviously none of us know what exactly spirits are, if, you know, if they exist, with it, what it's like. But first of all, it would seem to be overly crowded, just because of all of humanity. But, but I don't imagine that they're really abiding by a clock.
Yes, you would hope that once we pass on, the last thing we need to worry about is keeping time, Mark.
Yeah, right.
There's another remarkable person in this period as well, which is Andrew Jackson Davis, which I didn't know too much about. I'd heard his name mentioned and heard of the term Summerland, but I wasn't aware of it. So for anybody who doesn't know Davis, Mark, what was his claim to fame and his alleged power?
Yeah, he was a very early spiritualist. In fact, he preceded the Fox sisters. So, you know, we say that the Fox sisters sort of kicked off modern spiritualism in 1848, but it's not like nothing was going on before them.
Mm.
There were certainly, of course, people believed in communication with the dead before them, but this particular movement was kind of already brewing a little bit. They just sort of really opened the door and paved the way.
Yeah.
But Andrew Jackson Davis also, in New York, he was from Poughkeepsie. Mm. So not exactly Western New York, but still sort of in the region. He was known as the Poughkeepsie Seer. And at an early age, he kind of, you know, was developing some kind of psychical power. He had a story that was similar to one I shared in the book from late 1600s with Lady Beresford and her ghost.
Yes.
This idea of childhood friends, one of them passing on and then seeing the other one shortly after to come back and, you know, leave a message.
Hmm.
And Andrew Jackson Davis and his friend were talking about this story about Lady Beresford one day, and then the friend ends up dying, and Andrew Jackson Davis sees him before he found out he died. He found out like days later that he had died, but he saw this friend's spirit So it was interesting that they had this story, and then he kind of had this experience shortly after.
Mm.
And then he later, yeah, had visions of Summerland, which was basically, you know, the afterlife, and described it as, you know, this magnificent place. You know, everything was beautiful and radiant, and, you know, obviously, you know, Summerland would kind of lend itself to that sort of description of something, you know, wonderful and then beautiful. And then he developed his powers further. You know, a mesmerist had come to town, which is like kind of early hypnotism, and called Andrew Jackson Davis to the stage as a volunteer, but nothing really happened. And then Davis met with a friend who would also seem to show some sort of powers after this show. And they began practicing and finding that he did seem to have a gift, and he could, you know, read contents from letters that were sealed and answer various questions. And it was kind of like became like a local sensation, you know, sort of putting on shows, but it was more for entertainment. And then he decided he wanted to do more than that. So he went on he kind of left town one night and went out into the Catskills and claimed to have met with Emanuel Swedenborg and Galen, you know, from ancient medicine, and came back with all this knowledge. And what's interesting is that Davis wasn't like well-schooled or anything. He may have done a lot of reading on his own, but as far as anyone knows, he wasn't, you know, like valedictorian by any means or anything like that.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that he came back with all this knowledge of Swedenborg and Galen, not having really known, or theoretically not having known who they were, but maybe, you know, maybe he did read about them and no one knew. Who knows? But it's interesting. And from there, he just began doing a lot of writings on spiritualism, talking about the afterlife, what the world is like. He predicted just before 1848 that soon there would be an occurrence that would open the door and have everyone believing. And lo and behold, the Fox sisters had their breakthroughs just shortly after that. So it seemed like he was prophesizing the event.
I mean, the Swedenborg thing is remarkable, because, I mean, often, and you mention it in your section about Davis, is that I think they said he had less than an hour's schooling, but he was also, he was known to be a voracious reader, which is one of those people where you think, well, was he just a naturally gifted young man who didn't need an educational background? And as you suggest, maybe he stumbled across Swedenborg, because Swedenborg's a very interesting person for him to refer to, Mark, because obviously Swedenborg was an eminent scientist and philosopher of his era, who in the latter part of his life really got into sort of trying to contact the spirits of the dead and sort of transmit his mind into the universe, wasn't he?
Oh yeah, he went everywhere. He met people from every planet, yeah, and wrote about all the different beings on all the planets and described them in great detail.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, of course, he visited heaven and described his vision of, you know, of the afterlife. And you sort of had a waiting room, and then you could choose which way you want to go, towards heaven or towards hell. Hell sort of was, in his mind, was just going back to hang out with the same low lives you might have in real life and deal with the same problems you dealt with in real life, which I think is a really interesting take on it. You know, like, okay, well, maybe that's not hell to you, but you're just putting up with the same frustrations and, you know, relationships you had before, versus the other direction, which, you know, things were a bit more enlightened and much better, of course.
That's one of those things, like you say, it is, if he's going to pick anybody out of history, it is odd to me that Swedenborg's the person that he claims to have met on this pilgrimage to the Catskills, which is, I'm not saying it kind of gives it a bit more credence, but it's, if anything else, he knew what he needed to say, which kind of lends me to think that he was a lot cleverer than people actually probably thought he was.
Yeah, he must have been. And then, you know, he wrote multiple books, you know, which are clearly they're well written books. So he was an intelligent guy, no doubt about that. You know, lectured everywhere about this. So yeah, he was pretty much a major figure in early spiritualism.
Yeah,
but yeah, I guess because he sort of preceded the Fox sisters, he's not maybe the most common figure when people think about spiritualism these days.
When you were researching it, Mark, did you kind of come to a conclusion that, because when I look at this, it's very interesting for me how certain techniques develop through the era. And obviously you've got the knocks and the tap-ins, and then we've got these, you know, the spirit cabinet and music being played. Or, you know, we're told it's music. I find it very hard to believe that it probably was. It was probably just somebody making noises.
Yeah, lots
all.
Of noise, I'm sure.
Oh, that's a trumpet or whatever. And yet, as it develops through the 19th century, you get people who start doing automatic writing and slate construction and table tipping and then the Ouija board. It's almost as if people had to have a gimmick to kind of say, well, I'm not like these people who are faking it. Look at me. I do it very differently.
Yeah, I think there's certainly some truth to that. And I think also just trying to be more efficient about getting these messages, you know, and how you can get messages a little bit faster than, you know, going through the alphabet and waiting for a knock to stop in a letter to stop the first letter. You know, it could be very tedious, you know, especially if you have lots of, you know, T's and, you know, W's and Z's and, you know. Yes. So yeah, I was like, oh, well, what if we try doing this? What if we try doing that? Maybe we can start to get messages a little faster, you know, particularly with automatic writing. And the Ouija board was still a one letter at a time thing, but, you know, having the planchette simplified things to some degree. So yeah, and sometimes it was just the notion of the shiny new object as well. Like, ooh, look at this.
Mm.
But I do love, you mentioned slate writing, and slate writing, I think, is a pretty fascinating one. One of the characters I wrote about was Henry Slade, who really, you know, ushered in the slate writing era.
Yes.
And he'd have the slates. They could be the kind, you know, it's like a little chalkboard that you could close up, put a little piece of chalk in, and you'd hear like scritching and scratching under the table. And then you pull out the slate and lo and behold, there'd be a message from the dead. Pretty great effect. And so, of course, he was caught numerous times in what he may have been doing, which, you know, one thought is he put a thimble on his finger under the table with a tiny piece of chalk and write it himself, unbeknownst to anyone, because that would seem like a difficult thing to do, which I'm sure it was. That's a great talent alone to be able to write with a tiny piece of chalk on your fingertip, yeah, anything legible. But the sloppier the writing was, the more believable it was it came from someone who was dead. So that also kind of, you know, helped him out, yes, quite into the effect. But he could also swap out one slate for another. You know, secretly hidden away with a message on, so he could. There are different ways he could create this effect, but you know, the inventiveness of it is quite something for sure.
Yeah, there does seem to be a lot of sleight of hand, and regardless of the subject of spiritualism, Mark, there seems to have been a lot of talented people who just saw an opportunity to make a lot of money, I think.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about what these mediums were doing, it is amazing. Even if they're not talking to the dead, what they could do was extraordinary. And what I love about all that is when you look at the different characters involved, you know, they're not people you'd expect to be able to learn these things. I mean, magicians could do all these. So magicians were usually the ones who were pointing out the frauds, right? Like Houdini was famously, you know, famously exposed lots of mediums. But before him as well, you had magicians who say, oh, they're just doing this, they're just doing that. But magicians would, you know, they were apprentices to other magicians. You know, they would learn from each other, right? These illusions were passed down or built upon. But you can see that they knew what they were doing, and they could learn these different things and perfect them and evolve them. And that all makes sense. That was their job. But here you have, like you mentioned, Eusebia Palladino, who's just an Italian peasant woman, you know? Marjorie, Mina Crandon, who's known as Marjorie, the Witch of Lime Street, is another great example. Who was that Boston housewife, who, like Leah Fox, had, you know, she'd been divorced and she had one child. So she was kind of on her own, fell in love with her doctor who, you know, started a family where they got married, and she was basically, you know, started doing these seances at her own home, conjuring up her deceased brother and convincing everyone. But the question is how did they learn these things? Like, how did they learn these techniques to levitate tables and make things appear in the room and move furniture and create these voices and ring bells, you know, enclosed in boxes, you know, produce ectoplasm. Like, how are they learning all these different techniques without, you know, apprenticeships?
Yeah.
You know, so it's remarkable that they could learn to do these effects and fool so many people because they were so good at it. So I love the fact that they figured these things out. It's, I mean, to me, that's almost as wondrous as talking to the dead.
Yeah. I think there's an interesting aspect when you cover a couple of these people, Mark, that, as you refer to, some people seem to have this power over their supporters, where they could get away with things and people would defend them till the end of the world. They just didn't care. And I think often when we've got things like this going on, there's also a real situation of belief here that people, regardless of the evidence of fraudulent behavior going on or that these people are just performing tricks, people didn't care. They believed it. And therefore, as far as they were concerned, it was real.
Yeah, I'll give a quick example of that because you're right. I mean, that's often the case. I think part of it is also if you're vocal about your beliefs in this person, maybe you just don't want to ever admit to being wrong. You know, yes. It might be a bit of an ego thing at play. So one example of that was from late 1800s, once the spirit photography phenomenon began, which started with William Mumler in Boston in 1861.
Yes.
But that spread, that also spread overseas. There was a Parisian photographer named Edouard Bouguet who produced amazing photos of spirits. They're really quite artful and beautiful. And he was brought to trial. You know, the government suspected he was a fraud, brought to trial. And he admitted that he had assistants and props to create all these different effects. Yet so many people who bought the photos swore that they were real and said, like, this is definitely, you know, my family member or my whatever it might be. They swore that it was real. And Bouguet's like, it was just a coincidence that it looks like that person, you know?
Yeah.
And so there was a spiritualist named William Staten Moses, who was, you know, a big believer and a big evangelist. And he had investigated 120 of Bouguet's photos and claimed, I believe it was 40 of them, he said were definitely showed known deceased people. So again, to him, that was evidence that this guy was legit. But here he, you know, admitted that he was a fraud in court, and Moses didn't accept it. You know,
yes.
Just like you said, he's like, nope, you're only saying that because either they're bribing you or they're putting you under pressure to say this. They're just forcing you to say it. But I know it's legitimate. So again, you can always find a reason to say that something that's even admitted fake is not.
Yeah. Well, once again, that parallels Maggie Fox, really, because when she'd admitted it was all fraudulent, people saying, oh, well, she's been paid to say that. And then she changed her mind anyway and said, actually, no, it's none of it's true. I am channeling the spirits of the dead.
Yeah.
So you're like, well, okay. let's just not accept any evidence then. Everything's real.
Yeah. You know.
Yeah.
Fascinating time.
Absolutely. Well, you touched on one of the other things that often I just shake my head at, Mark, when I look at these pictures, which is ectoplasm and the alleged ability to manifest it. And when we look at these photos now, I find it unbelievable that anybody fell for this. But once again, I think you've got this captive audience that want something, that believe in something, and therefore even something as tawdry and cheap as ectoplasmic creation seem to just convince people, and yet it's clearly material.
Yeah, it's material. In some cases, it was like pages from a magazine or newspaper that were sort of chewed up and, you know, be regurgitated. There's a famous case, and I think a couple images in the book that show this and talk about her case. Eva C., who had was investigated thoroughly, whole book written about her phenomena. And she was one of the early ectoplasm mediums. But the pictures are just crazy. And one of them, you can see like the name of the newspaper on the ectoplasm and the pictures. It seems so obvious, but they were believing it. And they'd have her inspected because she could either regurgitate or she could hide it in her orifices.
Yes.
And one of the women who was supposedly like, you know, a benefactor of hers would, you know, inspect her, but they were also lovers. So who knows how legitimate the inspection was. But this doctor who was investigating, you know, believed that, okay, she's been checked and she's clean and she's still producing this. So again, just all kinds of things were going on. You know, a lot of this was, you know, based on a relationship, you know.
Yeah.
Same thing happened with Marjorie. She had many of her investigators, including Hayward Carrington, had affairs with her.
Yeah.
And so she could maybe use them to her advantage and maybe had them help maybe unwittingly at times to create some effects.
Mm.
Cause she knew they might do what she asked, you know, that could help her create an effect.
Yeah.
So lots of things going on just within the human psyche and general, you know, human tendencies.
I think when you were researching book, one of the things that's always surprised me about this, as we're talking about this kind of boom periods for this explosion in the investigation and channeling, obviously you had the American Civil War and the First World War and that period of the 20th century. Do you think it's surprising that it didn't happen again after the Second World War, Mark? Or do you think that we were a little bit more learned, or that people were very conscious of some of the tricks and frauds? Let's be brutally honest about this, because there was a lot of people who took advantage of people suffering from a great deal of grief and trauma after these events. That's the reason it didn't occur to the extent after the Second World War, or do you just think that it probably carried on and we just didn't pay it attention?
I think that's a good question, you know, and I don't know for sure. I would think that, I suspect that part of it is what you said, that maybe there was a bit more awareness.
Mm.
Maybe people were less willing to believe that this was something that was possible. I also think that maybe what impacted, and this is sort of a similar effect. One of my earlier books was called American Sideshow, and kind of Sideshow also sort of had the decline around the same era. And I think part of it is you have new forms of entertainment that are competing. So if a seance, to some degree, a seance was a form of entertainment, right? We could go and we could do these things and it was something to go do. And you could believe it or not, but even if you didn't believe it, it could be quite entertaining.
Yeah.
And now you have, by after World War II, you know, early television, you know, movies. I kind of feel like maybe entertainment had something to do with it as well. There were more choices, more things to go do and how to spend your time, your money. And I suspect that maybe that had something to do with it as well.
Yeah, very true. But it's interesting as well, because I know, as you touch on the first section of the book, which is the history of ghosts, one of my favorite stories is obviously the ancient Greek one, which is one of those typical ghost stories that seems to have kind of been reborn in sort of 19th century literature, Mark, where we've got a wronged spirit rattling chains who needs help. And it's very interesting that that's, I think, one of the earliest, or probably the earliest example of a ghost story. And yet we see these kind of archetypes and situations continue all the way up to the modern day, don't we?
Yeah. Yeah. And that was one of those examples where the ghost basically leads a philosopher named Athenodorus to a spot in the backyard of this house he just bought that was known to be haunted by this ghost in rattling chains, and basically disappears into the ground. And Athenodorus digs up in that area and sees bones, you know, with chains binding the arms, and basically gave it a proper burial. So it goes into this whole notion of sometimes ghosts come back because they weren't buried properly. And it becomes a lesson, like, you know, respecting the dead and performing these rituals, and not leaving a spirit, I guess, restless. So that's a common theme. And it is interesting because that sort of still has passed through the centuries as a common ghost theme. But yeah, part of what's fascinating is these ghost stories have been with us since we've been here, you know, since humanity's been around. We've always had these questions about life after death and, you know, different ghost experiences and across cultures. And I get into this in that first section of the book. You see similarities across cultures, you know, Egyptian culture, the Book of the Dead, Aztec culture had similar journeys, long, arduous journeys through the underworld to come to your sort of eternal paradise. And it's not like these cultures came in contact with each other. You know, they could be thousands of miles apart. They were not contacting each other. It were also different eras.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, beliefs were very similar in lots of ways. And it does make you wonder, like, okay, did they know something? How were they all so similar? And have we lost anything over the centuries? The more enlightened we become with science and everything, have we lost anything from our spiritual knowledge?
Mm.
Or were these just things that were explainable by science and physics? And I get into some of those questions as well in the book. I mean, just to touch on a couple of examples, there's a frequency called infrasound that goes 18.9 hertz, and that can cause eyeballs to vibrate, cold sweats, fear, And when your eyeball goes through that vibration, and again, nothing you detect, it's not like you're going to feel it, but that could cause seeing like a shadowy figure in your periphery or something like that. So there are these different effects that are found. Infrasound is found in places commonly said to be haunted, cellars, narrow hallways, some of those haunted house tropes. Not to say it explains everything by any means, but there are these interesting effects that are just physics that you could interpret in different ways, and maybe your mind makes sense of because it doesn't understand what's happening as maybe a ghost or paranormal event. So there's lots of interesting questions. That's kind of what I love, and what I get into in the book is I'm not judging one way or the other. Like, there's definitely ghosts, there's not ghosts, but there's lots of evidence to show how some things might be explained, but lots of stories that there is no evidence to show how explained, and leaves the mystery wide open, which I love. I love that we don't know the answers to these things. It keeps the fascination alive for all of us, and that mystery and wonder is part of the fun of it all.
Oh, absolutely. When you were researching the book, Mark, what was the most surprising thing you uncovered? Did anything sort of strike you as unusual or make you think, why have I never heard about this as much before?
I think a little bit of, so what I just explained, I think, is one of them. You know, how science explained a few of these things. In addition to the infrasound, there was another interesting experiment called, it's from a Canadian professor named Michael Persinger, who made a creation called the God Helmet.
Yes.
And he would have volunteers go in a room and do this for, you know, for years, have complete sensory deprivation, dark room, no sound, nothing, put the God Helmet on. And this God Helmet would sort of have pulses of electromagnetic, fields going into the temporal lobe. And based on how much you would dial that up or down, people would have different experiences. They might think they saw God, hence the name the God Helmet, or aliens or ghosts. And so here's, again, an interesting way to say, like, how is the mind working with these different forces around us? And how is it interpreting things? And what kind of messages is it forming to explain away different things going into the brain? You know, so that I thought was fascinating. Again, not to say this explains everything, because it doesn't. Because on the other side, there's a story I have from a parapsychologist named Lloyd Auerbach that I thought was really interesting. And I have other stories, too, from just, you know, modern people, you know, current day stories that seem very hard to explain. But his, I thought, was a great example where he had a friend who'd passed away, and he was driving to the airport. And this friend was wrote a lot about aviation. Driving to the airport, he's got a relatively new car, he described. So there's no smells in the car or anything like that. Probably still had new car smell. And he smells cigar smoke. And he said, this was the same brand of cigar smoke that my friend smoked. Like, I recognize that as his cigar smoke. And it was strong. And he said about, he spoke to a friend later that day who said that he had the exact same experience while flying a plane on the East Coast. And Lloyd was on the West Coast at the time. 10 minutes later, exactly 10 minutes after his experience. And a third friend they spoke with had the same experience 10 minutes after that. So they all had this olfactory sensation that seemed to signify their friend's presence within moments of each other. So things like that I find fascinating. Like, that to me, I don't know where infrasound or electromagnetic fields, I don't know where that could come into play with something like that. So I found it really fascinating to find stories that seemed really difficult to explain away in terms of, you know, scientific explanation. And then on the flip side, you know, scientific explanations that could maybe explain away certain things. So again, it all just leads to more wonder.
Yeah, absolutely. I've always found stories in regards to scent, Mark, rather quite, they're quite emotionally charged, I think, because often it gives people a really nice feeling of someone that's departed. And often the aroma that they encounter, or the scent or the smell, seems to put them in a good mood or take them back to a happier time and reminds them of good times. And I think often we can be quite dismissive in regards to the paranormal and things like that, or certain people certainly can be. And I think sometimes they overemphasize the clinical or the scientific methodology behind it all, whereas often some people have a really positive emotional response to some of these events, and I think often that gets overlooked.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's also, I also find it odd that ghosts have even become a thing for people to fear. Because I feel like any experience you have, whether it's, you know, an olfactory or some, you know, maybe it's seeing something in your mind's eye, that you believe is evidence of someone that you know, and there are lots of these amazing cases, you know, tons of them.
Yeah.
And to me, that seems really exciting. You know, if that's an answer to whether or not there's something after death, that seems just like great news, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's a fabulous book with a wonderful collection of stories and sections. There's many things I could talk to you about, Mark, in regards to this book, but I don't want to spoil it for any prospective new purchasers of it. I will say the bit that always makes me chuckle is the section about dead authors coming back. The Mark Twain story is one I'm very aware of, especially the reviews of Mark Twain's new work, shall we say.
Yeah, I love this.
Which always makes me chuckle. And, you know, Shakespeare and Poe and things like that. And that's another facet of all this, is that, you know, you'll get people who will say, oh, yeah, I'm channeling this person. And usually the proof is not in the pudding, shall we say, when the quality of the work is unveiled to the world. So for anybody trying to track it down, Mark, where can they get hold of a copy and keep up to date with your work?
Well, the book should be available in any bookstore. Certainly you can go on Amazon, at other online booksellers, and you can check out all my other books, including this one, at markhartzmanbooks.com. It's Mark, MarkHartzman, books.com. So I have everything up there and links to purchase there as well.
Fabulous. So what's next for you, Mark? I've heard you mention in the past that you've also got a deep interest in ufology.
Yeah, I'm working on that. So so this book, Chasing Ghosts, is with Quirk Books, as was The Big Book of Mars. And I'm working with them again on a new book that will be, centered on UFOs and ufology. So that's underway, and I'm excited about that. It's another fascinating topic. With tons of stories, a lot to dive into. Again,
yes,
going back through history up to now, there's so much material. So that's been exciting.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I look forward to that, and hopefully I'll get the chance to speak to you about that when that's released.
Absolutely. That'd be great.
Oh, well, fabulous. Well, Mark, I'll put links to everything in the show notes, as I say. I really recommend Chasing Ghosts. It's a wonderful collection, and I do like your very balanced and humorous take on it all. It's a wonderfully written book.
Thank you so much.
Took a trip down my childhood memory lane for some of these stories and learned something new, which is always a good thing. And like I say, it's full of beautiful images and a humorous take on some of these situations in the paranormal history. So I congratulate you on it, and I wish you all the very best.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate that.